That is the WNPR love theme. And so usually you would hear, not just the WNPR love theme, it's the Where We Live love theme. And usually you would hear John Dankosky start talking. He, however, is physically unable to play, as they say in the NFL. And so this is Colin McEnroe. I'm sitting in for him on The Wheelhouse, which is a weekly roundtable about politics and government and related issues here in Connecticut. Joining me today is Harriet Jones, WNPR's very own business reporter, Daniela Altomare, State House reporter for the Hartford Courant. We'll have some other guests as well as we plow through a whole series of issues. I feel totally inadequate. I can never fill the boots of Mr. Dankosky, but bear with me, and then if it really is just a disaster, we'll give you some email addresses where you can write to complain. They'll be up at WNPR.org later today, you know, if you just want to say, never let this happen again or something along those lines. All right, so let's get right down to business here. Let me just tell you a little bit about what we'll be talking about as we go along here. At the beginning, we are going to talk a little bit about lieutenant governorships, which is admittedly not a sexy topic. John Nance compared the vice presidency to a bucket of warm spit. And Dan Quayle felt obliged to say that he was not a potted plant in meetings. People don't like being vice president that much. And in fact, here in Connecticut, Kevin Sullivan famously tried to avoid being made lieutenant governor when John Rowland had to step down owing to scandal. His lieutenant governor stepped up to the governorship. That meant that the president pro tem of the Senate had to rise up and become lieutenant governor. And Kevin Sullivan, who was occupying that post at that time, did not want that to happen. And anecdotally, supposedly, tried to arrange it so that he could switch places very quickly with, I think, his majority leader. So that guy, Billy Seattle, would wind up as lieutenant governor. But he was persuaded that it wouldn't look good. Anyway, some people actually run for lieutenant governor. And we have that going on here in the state right now. We'll tell you a little bit about that. It's not unheard of. As a matter of fact, you may have forgotten this by now. But for a while, Kevin Lembo ran. Do you remember, Danielle? For a while, Kevin Lembo was running for lieutenant governor last cycle.
Yep.
Mike Gargiura may also. He ran for almost everything at some point or other. So he may have. So I touched his foot into the lieutenant governor line. But before we get into that and tell you about at least one of the people seeking that job right now, we're also going to talk to Alan Greenblatt. Alan Greenblatt, a writer for NPR.org. And he has been writing about the kinds of troubles that lieutenant governors get into. Alan Greenblatt, here in the state of Connecticut, it's sort of the other way around. The governor gets into trouble, and the lieutenant governor is so far out of the loop that she can usually plausibly say she had no idea what was going on. But you've actually found some instances where it's sort of the opposite, right?
Well, that's right. We've had four lieutenant governors resign in the past year, including the lieutenant governor of Arkansas, who resigned last Friday for some campaign finance violations.
And is there a thread running through all these? I mean, you looked at this in a whole bunch of different states. Is it idle hands are the devil's plaything? Is it just lieutenant governors have so much time on their hands and they're not supervised well enough?
Well, all the four who've resigned in the past year in Nebraska and Florida, up near you in Massachusetts, and then this fellow in Arkansas, they all had different scandals. There were late-night phone calls to women, and there was a charity that had some racketeering questions, and then Timothy Murray up there in Massachusetts, who was found speeding at 100 miles an hour in his state-issued vehicle. I mean, there's not some common theme where they all get into trouble because of campaign finance or that kind of impropriety, but that does seem to be the recurring theme that, A, they don't have enough to do, B, when they do get in trouble, lieutenant governors will get media attention, and C, in the first place, a lot of these people weren't well known. They weren't well vetted. It's not like running for governor where people look into every nook and cranny of your life. In a lot of states, the lieutenant governor is just picked as a running mate by the person running for governor, and often for reasons such as gender balance, or they represent an important part of the state, or racial balance. Florida's Governor Rick Scott yesterday picked a new lieutenant governor. He waited 10 months to fill the job, which tells you something about the urgency of the position. But he was being sued by an activist for letting it sit idle for almost a year, and he picked somebody from Miami-Dade, a county he lost by a substantial margin last time around, and he picked a county property appraiser named Carlos Lopez Cantera, who is Cuban. He made a remark at the press conference yesterday. I think there will be a little more Cuban coffee in the governor's office. And Lopez Quintero, you know, he's been a state legislator, he's a property appraiser, but, you know, these are not high-profile jobs. A lot of people had turned the job down in Florida, and, you know, I'm not saying there's anything shady with this guy, but if there is, he may not have been properly vetted.
I mean, even the means of the ascension of a lieutenant governor isn't standard across the United States, right? In some cases, lieutenant governors run separately for the job and really are kind of almost sort of separate entities from the governor. In some cases, even have almost theoretically almost maybe a little bit more power than the governor. And then, as you say, in some cases, it really is sort of an accessory to the governor, something that he wears on his charm bracelet.
Well, that's right. I mean, there's certain states, mostly in the South, like Texas is, I think, the most famous example, where the lieutenant governor is he's essentially in charge of the state Senate. So, you know, that's a position of real power, whereas the governorship in Texas is relatively weak. But those are unusual. There are a few states that I think it's five states that don't even have a lieutenant governor. In New Jersey, they never had a lieutenant governor until a few years ago because, like you say, governors get into trouble, and they'd had a couple of governors resign or leave office, and so they needed somebody there just in case, you know, like your own Jody Rell and John Rowland. But it varies widely across states. Some places the governor just gets to pick who his running mate is. There's states like Maryland where the people running for governor this year have already picked their running mate. Sometimes the party at a convention, like in Connecticut, will pick somebody, or there'll be a primary system. But it's totally, totally variable.
Actually here in Connecticut, right on the governor's office, the lieutenant governor's office door, there's a pane that says break glass in case of emergency.
Yeah.
That's how they're actually sort of deployed. You know, one of the kind of odd cases in California, Gavin Newsom, a real rising star as mayor of San Francisco and you know, maybe had a couple of little setbacks here and there along the way. Suddenly he's lieutenant governor and almost does appear, at least temporarily, trapped in the amber of that essentially ceremonial job.
Well, that's right. I mean, he had a remark last year. He said, "I feel like I've succeeded in finding a million ways not to do something." And he's been very careful not to. Jerry Brown, who's the governor, seems to have no use for him, even though their families go way back. But he's been very careful not to overstep his bounds. But when Jerry Brown was governor back in the 70s, you know, sometimes they're just an appendage to the governor, but that seems to work better than if they're independent. In the 70s, Jerry Brown had a lieutenant governor named Mike Curb, who was a Republican, and Brown, of course, is a Democrat. And when Jerry Brown would leave the state, Mike Curb would make appointments and sign bills. And the fellow who was just stepping down in Arkansas, his name is Mark Darr, he's a Republican, and their governor, Mike Beebe, is a Democrat. Darr was signing a couple of bills when Beebe left the state. And so, you know, it's better to have them on the team, like you say, there if they're needed, than independent actors who can get into trouble.
Alan Greenblatt, you may be, you probably are, the nation's number one leading current expert on lieutenant governors.
It's a high demand position.
Yeah, people must back away from you at parties. But you do know your stuff, so this is great. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, that's great. Thanks very much for having me.
All right. That's Alan Greenblatt from NPR. Now, let's sort of talk about the state scene. First of all, Danielle Altamari is somebody who kind of covers the state capitol a lot. Do we have a sense yet? I'm not sure I have a sense yet of what kind of lieutenant governor Nancy Wyman is. I mean, she's often at Dan Malloy's side at briefings looking very stern and sober. But in terms of sort of the impact that you feel of Nancy Wyman, first of all, do you feel an impact?
Yeah, she's standing next to the governor in her beautiful high heels. But she, as you pointed out before, you know, she compliments him and sort of, you know, he's a guy of a lot of hard edges, and she's not. She's very popular, very well-liked, very charming and engaging. And I think, you know, she brings a lot, you know, on the policy side. You know, she was state comptroller, so her mission was largely related to things of the budget and healthcare reform. And, you know, she hasn't had a really visible role in a lot of those things. She's very active with veterans groups, but a lot of that does seem to be, you know, kind of ceremonial. So it's not really clear. But I think, you know, from the political side, she brings a lot to him and to the administration.
You know, Harriet, we've got one office seeker now, David Walker. Not a real familiar name necessarily to people who cover Connecticut state politics, although we should say that's not entirely unusual with people seeking the lieutenant governor's office or getting the lieutenant governor's office. I remember when Michael Fedeli was promoted as Jody Rell's running mate, we all had to sort of check our notes and try to remember exactly who Michael Fedeli was. He hadn't been around for a while. But tell us about David Walker.
Yeah, maybe more familiar actually on the federal scene, because former Comptroller General, head of the Government Accountability Office, he actually chose that title. It used to be the General Accounting Office, but he thought it should be the Government Accountability Office. And a real fiscal hawk. He's very, very tight on fiscal responsibility in government and paying down debt. And he actually, he gave a press conference this week on, you know, launching his campaign for lieutenant governor, which was kind of a surprise. But this was the issue he chose to major on. This is the issue. He almost admitted in the press conference that he basically has got into this race to showcase this particular issue. He said he's going to have answers for us on other issues that may come up within the campaign, but this is the issue that he wants to raise. He says he can get more profile as a candidate to raise that issue.
Let's hear a little bit of David Walker.
Well, there's no question I believe I'm qualified for governor. And quite frankly, I think the first thing that somebody should ask for a lieutenant governor is, are they qualified for governor on day one? If they're not, they shouldn't be considered. We have several quality candidates and some that are thinking about running in the offing right now. Quite frankly, I'm getting in very late in order to be able to qualify for public financing for governor. I'm not a wealthy person. I've spent most of my life in public service, either in government or the not-for-profit sector. But the key thing is, I'm qualified for governor on day one, but I can work as an effective partner with whoever the next governor is to turn this state around and create a better future.
Harriet, has he talked very specifically about his ideas about the Connecticut economy? Or, I mean, do we know a little bit more than the fact that he's apparently qualified to be governor?
Yes, he has. In fact, he produced a report. He co-authored it with Fred Carstensen. He moved to Connecticut a few years ago. He lives in Bridgeport, and he was shocked to discover the state is not what he would call fiscally responsible. So he produced this report, co-authored with UConn's Fred Carstensen. It was called Connecticut at Risk, and it had a cartoon of the USS Connecticut, a leaky tub going through the waters, kind of mine-infested waters. So he has set out what he thinks the state has to do to get back to fiscal responsibility, to get back to economic growth. And, you know, state employee pensions seem to be his particular bugbear. That seems to be the thing that he's focusing on the most. He thinks that the governor should reopen the CBAC agreement. He criticized Governor Malloy for making such a long agreement when he did renegotiate with state employees. He thinks that needs to be reopened.
He's not the only person running for lieutenant governor. Penny Bakayoki, right?
Yep. State legislator. So,
and we don't know at this point. It's January. Already two people are actually running for lieutenant governor, which is sort of hard to process. And really, the reality of this is that it's more of a position that winds up in play in various ways, and some of the ways that Alan suggested too, right? You solve a problem by finding the right lieutenant governor.
Yeah, exactly. And also, as the governor's race shakes out, some people certainly on the Republican side may choose a different office.
Right. Yeah. If you start getting squeezed out of the office you're looking for, you might be prepared to bargain. You might be prepared to throw whatever support you've got over. And it can get very complicated. One of the first elections that you covered, Daniela, we saw the Democratic Party undergo this kind of complicated shuffle in which John DeStefano won the primary. But the running mate of Dan Malloy also won the primary.
Yeah.
So we had sort of a mixed ticket that day.
That was awkward.
Yeah. So Mary Glassman won the ticket. Poor Scott Slifka, who's an excellent mayor. I live in West Hartford, but I think he felt kind of rejected on that occasion. All right. So one of the things that happened this week is that and it kind of plays into an article that Daniela did. By the way, our number, if you want to call in and talk about any of this, if maybe you are a former lieutenant governor, Eunice Gurek, call in 860-275-7266. Whoever you are, you can call in at 860-275-7266. And, you know, one of the things that happened this week that kind of plays into an article that Daniela did was that David Walker also talked about – he was asked a question about gun control. He just basically said essentially – that he wanted to talk about fiscal issues, that was his strength. You know, he just saw himself as stronger on fiscal issues and job issues. And down the road, he would get into some of these other, as he called them, social issues. But they weren't priority one for him right now. And what we saw, Daniela, and I'm sure you get the same emails that I do, the Democratic attack machine just pounced on him like a dog on a rabbit.
Yeah, press release after press release. I mean, it's, you know, and that's just the way it is. Whenever any of these candidates or would-be candidates or potential candidates or exploring candidates says anything at all or tweets anything or thinks anything, the Democrats are geared up and they're going to respond in a big way.
And this is something you wrote about in general, about the gearing up, the ramping up of the Democratic operation, which seems to be better oiled and better organized maybe than we've ever seen it.
Yeah, it's clearly something new. I mean, they have a lot of money and they're going to spend it. And, you know, as they say, they have a responsibility, in their words, to, you know, set the record straight, again, in their words, on the votes and the background and the views of the Republican candidates. So they're going to use it. They're going to be extremely aggressive.
So this is going to involve so-called trackers. In other words, people are going to, if you're a Republican candidate or represent any kind of other menace to the Democratic aims, you're going to have somebody following you around and probably videotaping everything that you do, which can then be fly-specced to see whether you said anything wrong. Although in the case of David Walker, I'm still not sure what it is that he said. What he said sounded pretty reasonable, which was, you know, he's mainly a fiscal guy so far, and you talk about the other stuff later.
Yeah, they took umbrage, though, that, you know, it was somehow insensitive or, you know, lacked an understanding or sensitivity to the Sandy Hook families, because he basically said he called it a social issue. And, you know, I'm not sure gun control, is that a social issue? I don't know. They felt it was very dismissive.
Yeah, he was trying to differentiate it anyway from fiscal issues.
Yeah.
All right. So we're going to be talking a little bit more about state politics in the next segment. Harriet Jones and Daniela Altomare will stay with me. We'll take a little break right now. When we come back, a figure from Connecticut's political past has a very interesting national job that he's about to enter. We'll tell you about that after this. And this is Colin McEnroe. Welcome to Where We Live. Mr. Dankosky should be back very soon, but right now I am the totally unqualified replacement for him. Let me just clean up a quick call for the previous segment before we get into our next story. Here's Terry calling in from Watertown. Hi, Terry.
Hi, how are you? What's your name again?
It doesn't really matter. You can call me John Dankosky.
Okay. And I was in the governor's office in the 70s when Mescal was the governor and Clark Hull was the lieutenant governor. And it was true that the lieutenant governor didn't have much to do, but the first time Mescal left the state, Clark came into the governor's office and put his feet up on the desk, and the press came down to find out what he was going to do. And he said he was going to attack Massachusetts, mobilize the governor's foot guard to attack Massachusetts to straighten out the border between the states, you know, that little notch in the border.
Oh, yes, the notch, yeah.
And then subsequently, Mescal left again once on the state plane, and it was grounded in Massachusetts, and the press ran down to find out what Clark had to say about that. And it was an Apache, a single-engine plane, and Clark said, from now on, I'm going to insist that the governor fly in a single-engine plane. Actually, the Apache was a double-engine plane. I thought those were kind of amusing and showed a little imagination on the part of the governor.
D. Clark Hull was absolutely, without a doubt, the most colorful lieutenant governor we ever had. And he was a very, very funny guy and was a big hit on the banquet circuit. But, I mean, there were other risks for Tom Mescal going away, too. I mean, not only did he have to worry that T. Clark Hull was going to attack Massachusetts, but, of course, he was away during the famous ice storm. And it cost him quite a bit of political capital that he wasn't here when the state was trapped in all that ice.
Clark was appointed to the appellate court when it was, when the Supreme Court was overwhelmed and they formed the appellate court. And Clark was on that court, and he used to refer to it as Brand X.
Right. Well, listen, thanks for those reminiscences. We're going to, in just a second, be talking to Miles Rappaport, who's the brand new head of Common Cause. We're having a little trouble getting to him right now. So let me just switch gears for a second and go over to Harriet Jones and talk about a couple of business-related stories that Harriet, our business reporter, has been covering. As soon as we get to Miles, we'll sort of jump back there. But one of the, I don't know whether Daniela has this experience, but what I used to find as a legislative reporter is you kind of cover bills and they get passed. And then you'd sort of forget about them. You'd sort of wonder, yeah, I think I did cover that, and I think it did get voted in and signed into law, but whatever happened to it? So one of those, for some people, is the Paid Sick Leave Act. So What's happened with it? There's been a study actually evaluating whether some of the concerns that were voiced about it at the time of its debate and passage were valid.
Yeah, so we were the first state in the nation to pass a mandate for paid sick leave for all companies over 50 employees. So, you know, we are an interesting test case and there's a good case to be made we should be studied. So a study came out earlier this week from the Center for Economic and Policy Research, which is a left-leaning think tank in D.C., a progressive think tank. And they'd previously done a study about California's paid family leave mandate. So my impression talking to them is they do come to this issue with a particular point of view. But they had some interesting studies. We don't know the full methodology for their study yet. They just released preliminary findings. But they talked to 250 companies in Connecticut, chosen at random, they said, from Dun & Bradstreet. And they did in-depth interviews with 15 of them, site visits with 15 of them. And the overall conclusion of their study was that we've seen a good impact on the employee side. More employees now have access to paid sick leave. There has not been a big impact on employers. Some of their figures, though, are kind of interesting. They said that only 10% of employers reported that the law increased payroll costs by 3% or more, which they were representing as low figures. I think most companies would tell you if one mandate adds to their payroll costs by 3%, that's a pretty big impact. So, you know, interesting figures. 15% said they'd increased prices. 10% said they'd reduced employee hours as a result of the law. On the other side of the coin, two-thirds of employees said that they had actually taken up, they'd used the benefit, but they'd used less than half of the days available to them. 84% of employers said they hadn't seen any abuse of the law. So an interesting study. There was a study last year from the Employment Policies Institute, which is a right-leaning think tank, that came out with almost opposite conclusions, saying that there'd been a big impact on employers. So I think, you know, we're at the point where you pay your money, you take your choice. I don't think we've seen the definitive study from a disinterested group yet on this issue.
I thought one of the surprisingly low numbers in the study, and I think it might have been 19%, was I thought there would be more – one of the positive impacts would be there would be just more reporting of employees who did not come to work when they were sick, which is sort of – I mean, ultimately, you kind of want that as an employer because you don't want your entire workforce getting sick because somebody feels like they have to charge in there.
Right. That was touted – you know, Dan Malloy touted that as one of the big benefits because one of the industries that has seen the most impact is hospitality and restaurants where, you know, there's a lot of contact with food, contact with customers. So you don't want to see people coming in when they're sick. So if you have paid sick leave, presumably they can feel happier about staying home.
That might have to be measured more by a public health study because really there's a bullet effect here. Obviously, if the guy with the flu comes and works at the salad bar, a whole bunch of other people at businesses get sick who don't understand why they got sick. So,
right. So maybe CDC has to come in and look at our paid sick leave.
It's an epidemiological question, I think, rather than a legislative one. All right. Well, we're ready now with Miles Rappaport. Miles Rappaport was, I think, from 95 to 98, the Secretary of State of Connecticut, also a state legislator, especially during the very turbulent time of the imposition of the state income tax. Also one of the founding fathers of Connecticut Citizens Action Group, CCAG. Since then, he's gone on to create a different group, Demos. And yesterday it was announced that he is the new president and CEO nationally of Common Cause. Miles Rappaport, welcome back to our airwaves.
Thanks very much. Glad to be with you.
So, Miles, first of all, for people who are a little foggy on the mission of Common Cause and also maybe have not kept up to date with any ways in which Common Cause has added to or redefined its mission, what's Common Cause all about?
Well, Common Cause was founded 43 years ago and has a tremendous history as a citizen lobby. John Gardner, who founded it, said basically everybody in Washington is organized except for the people. And they have built a strong grassroots organization with 400,000 members across the country and 35 chapters, including a very strong one in Connecticut. And I think they've had some major accomplishments along the way. They have been, Common Cause was pivotal, really, in the creation of the whole campaign finance regime, now, of course, under attack from the Supreme Court. They have been very strongly supportive of filibuster reform, which has been a tremendous victory this year. And they've been around the country major supporters of voting rights and access to the vote in numerous ways. So it's trying to make our democracy as vibrant, as inclusive, as accessible, as transparent as it possibly can. And I think they've done a great job with it, and I'm excited to be joining them.
You know, as you look down the road, I mean, you said under attack by the Supreme Court. I mean, some would say that attack was mounted and concluded, that the Supreme Court ultimately did significantly damage clean election laws with the Citizens United case. So is this sort of an ongoing conversation, or is this picking up the rubble after the explosion? I mean, how do you see post-Citizens United the mission of clean election laws?
Well, I'd say two things. One is that there are still campaign finance laws that can meet the Supreme Court's tests, as narrow as they are. Connecticut being a terrific case in point. I think Connecticut's public financing law, which Common Cause was instrumental in getting passed in 2005, is really a model for the country because it provides strong public resources for candidates so that they don't have to go around with a tin cup begging for money from wealthy donors. And that's been held constitutional by the Supreme Court. But I also think that there is a real conversation going on about whether about the influence of money in politics when we see the super PACs and Sheldon Adelson and the Koch brothers and, you know, all of that going on. I think that there's a real debate still to be had. I don't think it's rubble at all. I think I think you're right. I think it's an ongoing conversation. And I think ultimately even the courts, up to and including the Supreme Court, probably not this Supreme Court, but a future one, will change the way they, based on the facts on the ground, will change the way they view what we need to do about campaign finance.
Miles, we've got Daniela Altamari from the Hartford Current here. She has a question for you.
Hi.
Hi, Daniela.
I'm just wondering, you know, we've seen over the past couple of days a fascinating series in the Times about state legislatures and how increasingly we're seeing sort of one-party rule at the state level, whether it's Republicans or Democrats. Obviously, in Connecticut, it's Democrats. You know, with so little happening in Washington and so much gridlock there, I'm just wondering, you know, from Common Cause's perspective, is a lot of the action moving to the states? You talked about your 35 state chapters. I'm just wondering if you have any sense that, you know, that's sort of where some of these looming battles over whatever the issue is, campaign finance or anything else, are going to be taking place.
You know, I think very much so. You know, Louis Brandeis famously said that the states were the laboratories of democracy. But I think the states over the next few years are definitely the place where, from a positive point of view, I would say, genuine reforms, whether they be on issues of income inequality, whether they be on campaign finance, whether they be in opening up the voting access, will be at the state level. And I think there are lots of states, and again, Connecticut is a good case in point, where there's a ballot initiative on the ballot in November to open up the possibility of early voting and mail-in voting for the state of Connecticut, which I think would be a terrific thing. On the other hand, you're right, Danielle, there are certainly many, many states, North Carolina comes to mind most clearly, you know, where there are assaults on voting rights and voting access and the ability and the basic right to vote for many, many people. And I think there are defensive fights as well where kind of those kinds of voter suppression laws, I would call them, are going into effect. So I think what Common Cause can do is in those states where there are opportunities for genuine positive and forward-looking reform, take advantage of them and move forward. And in the states where it's a matter of fighting back against conservative and sort of anti-voting reforms, push back. So yes, I think the states are key. But I do think that there is also a national conversation. I think the benefit that Common Cause has, the unique role that Common Cause can play, is that it has these 35 strong state chapters, but also a strong national presence as well.
We're talking to Miles Rappaport. He is the newly announced president and CEO of Common Cause, former Secretary of State here in Connecticut and a state legislator as well, active in the Connecticut Citizens Action Group. You know, Miles, it seems like one of the other challenges you face, I think actually the filibuster reform is an interesting example of maybe a new direction for these kinds of efforts. An organization like Common Cause, on the one hand, in order to be influential, you have to become at least enough of part of Washington culture to have access to everybody. But you also don't want to become so much a part of Washington culture that you begin to accept certain beltway truisms or things that are accept things as axiomatic that really ought to be in play. Do you see that as a struggle for Common Cause, figuring out how to maintain a sort of cordial but adversarial relationship with the power structure in Washington?
Well, having read this town recently, yeah. it's certainly a kind of a not a flattering picture of the way in which Washington operates. But I think the Common Cause has two things going for it. One is the fact that they have strong state chapters really keeps, I think, them grounded, because they have the National Governing Board, whose chair is Robert Reich, who certainly on the one hand knows his way around Washington and on the other hand has been a tremendous voice for reform. You know, I think represents those states. And on the other hand, I think there's a very strong history of just, you know, we stick to our principles, you know, starting with John Gardner and going through Fred Wertheimer and David Cohn and Scott Harshbarger and Shelley Pingree and Bob Edgar, who was a terrific head of Common Cause who died in April of last year. You know, there's a tradition of kind of putting your feet in the ground on basic principles that should be and can be bipartisan. And sticking to them. So I hope that I can continue that tradition.
Miles, you know, here in Connecticut, as you say, we do have an extant clean elections law that is basically still standing with some modifications post-court decision. But I think the other thing that we're looking at heading into the 2014 campaign season, reporters like Daniela will be really struggling to figure out where the money is coming from. Obviously, there are trackable areas of money and then not so trackable areas of money. And here in this state election, despite having public financing, it just seems inevitable that we're going to see quite a bit of spending, certainly in the congressional races, but I think also in the state races, spending from some of these more difficult to document kind of third party sources, these super PACs or 401(c)(3)s or whatever they're called. These various entities that are a little bit harder to understand exactly who's funding them and how they're spending their money. Is there anything that ultimately can be done at the level of reform in the teeth of the Citizens United decision to help these things be a little bit, help us make these things a little bit more accountable?
Yes, I definitely think there are. Ironically, one of the points that was made in the Citizens United decision was that, you know, the kind of limits on campaign contributions weren't so necessary because there was disclosure and people could always find out on it that, you know, sunshine is the best disinfectant. And in fact, though, as you say, it's very hard to track it. So I think there are state laws and the Federal Disclose Act that was, that has not been passed, but should be and could be passed, that would make sure that there's much more reporting. And frankly, I think that the SEC and the FCC as regulatory bodies really ought to require disclosure from corporations or the people that they regulate to do that. But here's the second really interesting thing. In Massachusetts, Senator Elizabeth Warren and Scott Brown signed what they called a People's Pledge, in which they promised each other that if there were outside spending that was negative, they would refuse it, and in fact they would contribute an equal amount to a charity of their opponent's choice. And that held. So one of the things that Common Cause is going to be working on is to try to get some of the high-profile races in the country in 2014 to get the major candidates to take that pledge, and that did effectively eliminate the what we call the sort of the dark money coming into the election. So I think there are things that candidates can do. I think there are things we can do legislatively, and we ought to do both.
Well, Miles Rappaport, congratulations on your ascension. When do you actually start your duties there?
March 10th. Until then, I'm still the president of Demos, which is an organization I'm deeply, deeply proud of that has really become one of the major voices for democracy reform and economic fairness reform in the country. So I'm sort of wrapping up my duties there in the next 2 months, and we'll start full-time at Common Cause in March.
All right. Well, congratulations. Thanks for joining us today. And, you know, as we round out this segment, Daniela, back on the in the area of money that more or less can be tracked and must be reported, you did recently report on the latest round of fundraising. And once again, the Democrats are posting pretty large numbers here in Connecticut.
Yeah, big, big numbers compared to the Republicans, certainly. The state party, which is, you know, effectively running the governor's unannounced reelection campaign, had a very good quarter. And Republicans picked up a little bit in December, but still really lagging behind the Democrats.
Some of the names were kind of interesting, too. Some of the people who are giving money to the Democratic Party are people that I actually thought were Republicans or at least arch-conservatives or from arch-conservative families. So they're having some success in quarters that I would not have predicted.
Yeah, yeah, it is. It's interesting.
All right. And, of course, another part of that, obviously, is that they were successful at the legislative level of changing the rules, changing the limits. So the party can actually now raise more money per donor.
Yep. Exactly.
And that helps. All right, so let's take a quick break here. When we come back, Harriet's going to update us a little bit more on some business news. We'll talk to Daniela also about the profile that's etched out of Dan Malloy's and the Democrats' economic development and jobs plan. This is Where We Live. Specifically, this is The Wheelhouse, our weekly roundtable about politics, government, and related news issues. John Dankosky is physically unable to play today. We hope to have him back very, very soon. This is Colin McEnroe sitting in. By the way, if you want to call in, 860-275-7266. I'm privileged to have with me in studio Harriet Jones, our business reporter, Daniela Altamari, State House reporter for the Hartford Current. I want to quickly also just because usually on my show, Kyone does all this for me, but so I have to remember to thank everybody. So we've got Lydia Brown on the board today, fabulous producer Lydia Brown. Tucker Ives has really helped to guide me through everything that I needed to know for The Wheelhouse. And Katie Tularsky, the executive producer, oversees everything for us. It looks to me as I'm looking in there like we might have Anna Novak on the phones today. Is that who that is? Okay. So I hope I thanked everybody. If I didn't, there are other people who definitely deserve it. I'm also going to just take one moment, one discretionary moment, to, not that I asked permission to do this, to quickly plug something that we're doing. On January 22nd at Watkinson School, that's Wednesday, a week from today, we'll be doing a show at 7 p.m. This is sort of some fusion of the Colin McEnroe show and a lecture series that I've initiated at Watkinson. It's on the healing power of music. And it's going to be an unusual presentation in the sense that we will have a neuroscientist and somebody in the burgeoning field of musical therapy to talk about sort of medical applications, ways in which music really seems to help people overcome trauma, overcome chronic medical conditions. We're also going to have two musicians who feel they have benefited in exactly that way. Kate Callahan will be there and Jim Chapterlane. They've both overcome significant medical issues. And it seems to have happened within the context of their lives as musicians. We'll be diving in and out of the conversation with concerts, too. In other words, well, Kate will be here with the Kate Callahan Band. They are amazing. Jim Chapterlane, who has played with and produced for everybody you've ever heard of, will sit in with them and maybe perform some of his own stuff. So it'll be both a concert and a conversation. It's open to the public. I think it's $15, which goes to various charities in the Hartford area. So that's Wednesday night. January 22nd, Watkinson School. Try to get it on your calendar. I think it's going to be a really interesting evening. All right. So we're going to move back to some business news. And, Harriet, it does seem as though, you know, virtually every week I hear Harriet Jones report about some aspect of the Malloy administration's either job retention or job creation plan. Usually it's often kind of a fusion of both. This week it was something called Total Mortgage. Tell us about Total Mortgage.
Yes. Yeah, so Total Mortgage Services is a company in Milford. I believe it's been in Milford for 15-plus years, began there. It has 140 employees. So this was the latest company to benefit from a state loan. It's getting $3.5 million from the state, some of which I think $1.5 million will be forgivable if they hit their employment targets. They're targeting to double their employment. They want to add another 140 jobs at their Milford headquarters, and they're kind of consolidating their headquarters in Milford. So that was, you're right, it is kind of the latest in a drumbeat of these. Today, Governor Malloy is going to Oxford Performance Materials, which is the, it was actually the first company that got a loan under the Small Business Express program. So yes, it's kind of playing into what Daniela was saying about ramping up his campaign. This seems to be the kind of the economic showcase of what he's done.
I mean, I really do think, Daniela, that this, so far anyway, this looks like it will be the centerpiece of his political message in 2014. I can create jobs. I can retain jobs.
Yeah, and I think it'll also be a fertile target for the Republicans because they're going to make his economic strategy the center point of their campaigns as well, and they're going to say that it's been a failure. So it'll really be interesting to see how that plays out.
Now, this doesn't just happen at the gubernatorial level. Earlier this week, Harriet, you attended a Democratic legislative meeting about this. Let's hear a little bit of Senate President Pro Tem Don Williams.
We have bipartisan legislation that affects in a positive way our economy and helps retain and create jobs. We have succeeded in the past, and we're going to continue to move Connecticut forward in 2014.
You know, Harriet, I think Daniel is right that this is going to be a debated and debatable point over the course of the campaign. How well did this work? To what degree did it amount to bribing businesses that were going to stay anyway to stay? And what makes it complicated, too, is, as you've pointed out, it happens at a whole bunch of different levels, too. There's the Small Business Express. There's the First Five. There's the Manufacturing Assistance Act, whatever that is, right? It isn't all one program.
Right. And I think you began to see the crafting of the message, Malloy's message at this Total Mortgage event. He said, we've helped 1,000 companies. We've retained or created 42,000 jobs. So that's the number that he wants to get out there. If you look at DECD's recently released report, so this retained or created figure, they've created, they say, 11,800 jobs. They've retained another 30,800. So the bulk of that figure is retained. And I think that's kind of a woolly concept. Did you retain these jobs? Would these jobs really have gone elsewhere? Would these people have been let go? Hard to say. It's hard to prove a negative.
And is it possible to look at the different programs and see which ones seem to work better? Small Business Express seems to be the one that we're talking about the most these days.
Yeah, I mean, they have funded around about 1,000 companies through Small Business Express. And they've had a lot of positive press from the business community for this program. I think in some ways it's like a counterweight to First Five. First Five is pretty controversial in some, it's seen as kind of corporate welfare. Why are we giving taxpayer dollars to these huge companies which may or may not have a long-term commitment to Connecticut? Small Business Express was seen as, we're going to give taxpayer dollars to companies that began here, that are embedded in the community, where the person who owns them actually lives here, perhaps was born here. These are the companies that do pay their taxes. So it's seen as, if you like, quote unquote, a more virtuous program. But as time goes on, as we get sort of further into the recovery, questions are being raised about why is public capital playing in this private space? Especially bankers are saying, okay, at the beginning of the Small Business Express program, perhaps the lending standards were very tight. Perhaps there wasn't all that much private capital out there. Perhaps it was filling a need. Now, banks are more willing to lend. So why are we seeing all this injection of public capital when these companies perhaps could be going to banks and getting a loan?
I mean, obviously, success has many fathers, failure is an orphan. There have been some failures. The most notable one, obviously, is the one that involving Mr. O'Garrow in Hartford. However, those are outweighed, I think, by the ones that have performed successfully, by far, significantly outweighed by those. But I think, you've raised another interesting question, which is, how long do you keep up this as a strategy, targeting an individual business and throwing money at it in a certain way, either to retain or create jobs, as opposed to creating infrastructure, permanent infrastructure that will be attractive to and beneficial to God knows what jobs and businesses that we can't necessarily anticipate or find to hand money to.
I think that's right. I mean, if you can look at, especially something like First Five is like the empty calories of economic development, if you like. It's like the sugar high. You get to go and cut the ribbon and stand there with the CEO and say, I brought 200 jobs to the state. But who knows whether they're going to stay? Whereas if you are making investments on especially education and infrastructure and the kind of longer term things like that, that's like your meat and potatoes. That's like your protein and your fiber and your economic development. It takes longer to pay off, but it creates an environment where all businesses thrive.
All right. Well, mentioning education gives us a flimsy segue to our very last and very quick topic. This switches us over to the world of UConn football, where Ernest Jones is not only the new running back coach, but he's also the player engagement specialist on the team. And so a quote that he made in an article about his new mission has created a certain amount of excitement, but maybe in the wrong way. I'm going to read – it's a fairly long quote, but I think going over some of it is worth doing. He says, just because you come to the University of Connecticut doesn't mean you won't have the opportunity to pursue your faith. No, you're going to be able to come here and love the God that you love. So we provide opportunities for them to grow spiritually in our community. So I'll get out and meet some people in the community. So when this young man, for example, says, I'm a Seventh-day Adventist, or I'm a Catholic, or I'm a Baptist, or I'm a Jehovah's Witness as well. Okay, here you go. And we're going to do things in our building, fellowship, non-denominational type things, players, coaches. And now here's the part that winds up in boldface. We're going to make sure they understand that Jesus Christ should be in the center of our huddle. And that's something that is important. If you want to be successful and you want to win, get championships, then you better understand that this didn't happen because of you. This happened because of our Lord and Savior. That's going to be something said by Bob Diaco. He's the new coach of the football team. And something that's going to be said by Ernest Jones. That's Ernest Jones talking about himself in the third person. That's who we are. So for all matters theological, we bend and bow towards Susan Campbell, formerly of the Hartford Current, now Robert C. Vance Chair for Journalism at Central Connecticut and Mass Journalism and Mass Communication at Central Connecticut. She blogs at hotdogma.com. Susan, first of all, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
This isn't really the first time sports and religion have fused in a peculiar way. I mean, on any given Sunday, there are various athletes thanking God and thanking Jesus for enabling, you know, the Dolphins to beat the Colts, which obviously presumes that either Jesus or God has something against the Colts, or at least are willing to give them up in favor of the Dolphins. So, I don't know, when you see something like this, what makes it a little bit more complicated here is this is in the context of a public university, right?
Exactly. And as you said, there's a huge connection between football and evangelical Christianity in particular. You can see under the eye black, John 3:16 etched on the faces of some players. The problem is he spoke too long, and we've all done that. If he had just stopped before he said Jesus Christ is at the center of our huddle, I thought it was a very inclusive message. He made a mistake, I think, that President Herbst handled it very well, but it's unfortunate because the long quote kind of left people out. Not kind of, it definitely left people out.
Yeah, and President Herbst, as of yesterday, and it's actually a letter to the editor in this morning's Hartford Current and a page one story by Desmond Connor, she's responded at public universities, "We value everyone in our community and treat each person with the same degree of respect, regardless of who they are, what their background is, or what their beliefs may be," which is kind of what he was saying at the beginning of his quote.
Yeah, he just stopped, but he didn't.
So anyway, she goes on basically to say that that those values of inclusiveness extend to the football field. It should go without saying that our employees cannot appear to endorse or advocate for a particular religion or spiritual philosophy as part of their work at the university or in their interactions with our students. Although I don't know how much you've thought about this, but it always does strike me anyway as odd. I mean, you can understand the natural impulse that an athlete or a coach has, if he's a faithful person, a person who believes, to then fuse that with his mission.
Oh, sure, absolutely. And I actually think he has a good idea. If players come to stores and they have a faith community, he has offered to reach out to other faith communities and plug them in. And I think that's wonderful. That's a stability. That's great. It's if you're trying to convert someone or find someone a new faith community where you've overstepped your boundaries. But it's very, you see it all the time, that a player will point to heaven, and they're not pointing to heaven over their mother. They're pointing to heaven to thank God for that touchdown, which begs the question, is God really watching football that closely?
Right. Didn't you play volleyball at the college level?
I was not good, but yes. And I never once eye blacked my eyes, and I did not point to God if I spiked anyone.
You must have been pretty good. You were playing at you played for the University of Maryland, right?
No. Smaller college. I was not that good.
All right. But so you, even though you are a believer, you didn't infuse your volleyball activity with that?
No, I don't believe God really cared if I spiked or blocked anyone. I thought God had bigger things on her plate, so no. But that's just my theology. Other people may disagree.
All right. Well, it's the position of the wheelhouse and of where we live that you narrowly missed the Olympic team you're here. So Susan
Please
Campbell.
Tell everyone, yes.
Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
As we're kind of winding down here, first of all, I want to take a special moment to thank Daniela Altomare from you. Actually, you did two in a row. This is your second wheelhouse in a
row. That's right.
That's
yep.
Highly unorthodox, very unprecedented. But you were essential, I think, because of that really terrific article you did on the ramp up of the Democratic and Malloy campaign here in Connecticut. Harriet Jones, you are the force in business. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, I enjoyed it.
Thanks again to Tucker Ives, Lydia Brown, Katie Tularski, and Anna Novak, all the other people who helped out here today, whoever it is that I'm missing. Oh, and thanks to our friends from CTN. They're here, and I guess you'll be able to see this later on CTN and see my ill-fitting cardigan.